My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. In this episode, we speak with a man whose childhood is beyond words. We talk about heroin addiction, violence, hunger, and neglect. We also speak about sexual abuse and going into care, failure, fighting, and forgiveness. Episode 52, Nathan Dunn. This is Declassified. Mate, tell me about the memory of Christmas when you was younger.
So, the first memory of Christmas I ever had was really significant for me because it was the first time I woke up, and I remember waking up and opening my eyes, but then closing my eyes straight away and thinking, I wish that I didn't have to wake up anymore. And I wish that tomorrow, I hope I don't wake up, because what's the point? What's the point in me being here? What's the point in this life if it's going to be like this every day? So yeah, that was my first memory of Christmas for me.
Did Father Christmas visit you as a little one?
No, not that I remember. I knew that morning that there was nothing downstairs for me to go and open. You know, I didn't have any presents. I knew the day was Christmas, but it wasn't Christmas for us, you know. It was just another normal day in my life, and I didn't want to be in that life anymore. Yeah, I just didn't understand why I didn't have presents downstairs, or, you know, why I weren't like the other kids.
Was you born in Liverpool?
My earliest memories of where we lived was in Liverpool, yeah, on an estate in Croxteth.
And what's that estate like?
Oh, it was rough estate, very rough. Lots of memories of just random crazy stuff going on in that estate. I think around that time was very much the time where I think there was like a bit of a war going on between the two estates. So there was a lot of older kids trying to get the younger kids to do things, and a lot of bullying, a lot of violence. You know, houses getting petrol bombed, people getting shot all the time. Yeah, it was crazy place to live.
And did you ever feel, you know, when you're really little, did you ever feel safe outside the house? Did you ever feel safe when you were walking around the streets?
I don't think, from my earliest memory, I don't ever remember ever feeling safe anywhere, inside or outside the house.
Because it can be normal not to feel safe. It's the environment, you know, normal for you, is that right?
Yeah, it was very much like, this is life. I don't know any other form of life. This is what it's like. This must be what it's like everywhere. It's kind of like being in survival mode constantly, you know, and you've got to be in survival mode when you leave the door. You've got to be in survival mode when you come home as well. So
I want to keep us for when you're really at like 5, 6. What did mum and dad do for a living?
So my dad wasn't there. He was in jail, from what I'm aware. I don't know why he was in jail, but he was in jail most of my life, so I didn't know him. And my mum was, at this point, I don't think my mum was addicted to heroin like from when I was born, but a few years from like toddler age, I think that's when she met this guy, who's the dad of me, of a couple of me, a couple of my siblings. So he's not my dad, but she met him, and then he was a drug addict, and then she got addicted to drugs. So that's the story I've been told. I don't remember, you know, I was a baby, I think, around or really young toddler. So yeah, from my earliest memories, my mum was, I just saw my mum as a drug addict. So yeah, my dad, my real dad wasn't there, and I had a mum and a stepdad, if you like, who were both drug addicts.
And was it chaotic, the house? Was it clean? What was the actual environment? Was it warm? Was it friendly? What was it like?
From what I remember, it was like a downward spiral, which makes sense in terms of someone getting on drugs and then that drug addiction taking hold of their life and getting worse and worse and worse. So, there were things in our house, like, you know, normal things, almost a normal household from what, like, you could say. So, like, you had, like, a bed. But then those things disappeared very quickly. Things started disappearing. No sofa, no couch, no TV, food. Again, I must have had food before I remember, because I wouldn't be alive if I didn't. But from what I remember back to, food was hardly any. Then it got worse to none, the times where there weren't food. There are times where I'd have out of bins in the entry, because obviously the neighbours throw food out. And
but this is when you're really little, like 6 years old.
Yeah. So just everything in life began to get worse. Obviously I was in this chaotic world anyway of where we lived, but then that started to make things a lot worse, because then you're the druggies' kids, so the whole estate's not really looking at you, and then they are, and then the bullying starts, you know, paint getting thrown on the house and stuff written over the doors and just bullying from all the kids on the estate and stuff like that. I remember, like, these older lads, one time there was like this house that had been abandoned at the end of our road, and it was all like rubble in the front garden, like smashed plates and basically stuff from the house that had been thrown out. And this is what this scar is here. Was a plate that they were just playing frisbee with at me. So, like, they'd stood me on the wall and was like, they were trying to frisbee the proper glass plates at me. Mm. And one of them cracked me in the head, obviously cut my head open. And so it's just bored kids, if you like, doing things.
Who was looking after you?
No one. Just doing.
So you'd wake up 6 years old. You'd wake up in the morning. Where's breakfast coming from?
I don't remember. I don't remember having breakfast. I don't remember. I didn't have any. When we got to school, primary school, on the days that we went in, that's when I'd eat in school. And yeah, it was quite of a blur. Like, a lot happened then, but it was quite like a blur of time, seemed to move so quick. Or in my memory now, it feels like it was just so quick, all that time period. I just don't know. Life was about what me mum and stepdad were doing to get money each day to get drugs. So that was the main goal of the day.
Would you be seeing kind of drug paraphernalia and drug taking, or was that anything from you?
No, yeah, that was, you know, you'd walk in and they'd be both on the floor and crouch down on the floor with the tinfoil and taking drugs. And yeah, they're just so concentrated on that. That was their focus in life, and we didn't really matter. You know, like, I seen a drug dealer came in one time, front door's open, not closed. Come in, they were both on the floor, and he walked over to the guy who was with my mum. I was doing keep ups with a flyaway. I don't know why, but I was counting one, two.
What's a flyaway? Oh, like a tiny flyaway ball,
yeah. Again, it's weird because, like, we didn't have anything. And then I remember having these little tiny things, like a flyaway ball. I don't know where I'd got it from, somewhere on the estate. And it was like, that was like my prized possession. Something that there's no value in, that no adult's going to take away from you. And he just come in and slit his face. Well, he was that focused on taking his drug, he didn't even see the guy walk up to him. And he just slashed him while he's crouched on the floor. And I'm not even joking, the blood splattered all over me ball, because I always remember it. And for some reason, the thing that most annoyed me was I'd lost count of my high score of doing keepy-ups. And I just went back to doing keepy-ups. And I looked over, and he hadn't even stopped taking his drugs. The drug dealer got off, and then he just carried on, face bleeding, just carried on taking his, you know, his foil and his little. And I was thinking, as I grew older, I thought, is that how, like, determined they were to take drugs? And, you know, is that how bad that addiction is, sort of thing? But yeah, that was a daily thing, seeing him taking drugs.
I'm just trying to get a picture for you. Was the carpet on the floor, or was the floorboard, or,
you know, that old, like, concrete, marbly stuff?
Yeah.
That that. Yeah, I always remember that, the feeling of that coldness.
Cold, yeah.
Yeah. You know, when you like go upstairs and you can see your breath in the air and stuff. It was like, yeah, it was, I remember that. The house was just, it just got worse and worse and worse.
There were three kids in there, were there?
So there was definitely me, because I've got an older brother. So there's an older brother and me. And then there was my sister, who was, so my older brother and me have got the same dad. And then my sister was born. She was young. And then my brother, I think my brother was a baby at this point, like a proper baby. If not, he weren't born yet. I can't really quite remember when he was born. But definitely my older brother, me, and then my sister, who was half sister because her dad was this guy who was with us. And yeah, it was a bit weird when he came along because he was his general drug addict self. Didn't treat us like great, but when the daughter, as in his daughter, my sister, was there, it was almost like something switched and like we weren't his, even though he was a drug addict and he didn't really care about much anything anyway. It's like that was still his daughter and we weren't his. And that's when he started to really like do things where it was like I'd just be sitting there and he'd just slap me in the head. You know, he'd walk past and crack me and I'd be like, why have you done that? You know? But that was a daily thing as well, just getting hit and beat up and like not really bad thing. That was that wasn't that bad.
In the house?
Yeah, yeah, in and out the house, bullies outside the house, in the house.
Keeping the house for a sec. So the... Was it just your mum and her kind of boyfriend?
Yeah.
The kids. Was your mum and this guy violent towards you?
Not me mum, but he was, yeah. He was always, that's like the way it was. You got it, you got hit, you know, and like properly hit, not like a slap, like you see some people slapping the kids, which is not right, but he properly used to hit, you know.
Fist, close fist.
Yeah. Punch. Whatever he could get you with. A bit like Jekyll and Hyde, I suppose. Sometimes he'd be like, he'd be fine. And then sometimes he'd just, and I always thought, is it because we're not his? I don't know about what my brother experienced, but that's just from my point of view. Because I've never spoken to him about it, never asked him. But I felt like it was because we weren't his kids. That's why he was just taking it out on us. But I also, obviously, without jumping forward too much, I found out later on in life, he had a lot of mental issues, severe mental problems as well. Obviously, being on drugs is not going to help that. So that explained why sometimes he'd be okay, and like he wouldn't do anything to me, and the next thing he'd just punch me, or just, you know, it was just so like you never knew what was going to happen.
Was he in the house? Was he the only male? I mean, you mentioned a few minutes ago a drug dealer coming in and just slicing him. Was that an occurrence as well? Just other people coming in?
There were different drug dealers, coming in and out the house. On the occasion, like druggies coming in and out the house because they try to team up, I think, sometimes and go on the rob and stuff like that. And but we were moving around after that quite a lot. So, like, we were in Croxteth and then we moved to the Wirral. I think me mum moved away from him. Getting away from him. And then a week later, he was there, back there with her. So then it was when we moved to the Wirral that I was getting a little bit older, still around 6 or 7, but like getting older. And each time we moved, things got worse because obviously the stuff that you have in your house, you have to get to put in your house. So if you move to an empty house and you're not going to put anything in it, the house stays empty. So again, we're moving, and the bullying continued then because it was we were the druggies' kids. Everywhere we went, that seemed to get worse and worse. And then the addiction for me mum and this guy was a lot worse then.
You say a lot worse, you've been needing more.
Needing more, and their care for us, even though it wasn't much anyway, it got less and less and less.
So neglect.
Yeah. To the point where they then weren't aware of obviously what we were going through, what people were coming in and out the house, what drug dealers were doing, what to us. And yet it was, at that point, it was like, I didn't have any parents then.
It's like a different world to me. Because although, you know, from my personal point of view, my childhood was slightly chaotic. I still had a mum and dad that loved me and other people that maybe didn't. But other people weren't coming into the house and abusing me as a child.
Yeah.
In whichever form that is. What does that mean? So you kind of alluded to it there. So people would come in and do what? To a 6-year-old, a 7-year-old?
Yeah. Sorry, just trying to make sure I get my words right. One of the things, there was multiple things, lots of different experiences for me that were like, not the same, but still very traumatic in ways of abuse, physically and mentally. I've had these people do sexual things, then more torturous things, if you like, rather than it being a sexual thing, then mental abuse from different people in different ways, and all really yet related to the fact that people were coming and going in house sort of thing, and drug dealers were like, with a drug dealer, right, it happens so that like they either get caught, so then there's a new drug dealer on the estate, or my mum, for example, would owe them money, not pay, whatever it may be. There'd be some form of retaliation, violence, an act of something against our household, family, whatever you may call it. And then that drug dealer wouldn't obviously sell drugs to her again, and then she'd get a new drug dealer. So you've got these multiple different drug dealers coming and going, and once they're gone, you never see them again. So a lot of that happened, and I don't even think that my mum knows that. You know, I don't see my mum, don't speak to her. I don't think she knows. Well, half the time she was that drugged up. I don't think she knew what was going on.
Would they be doing stuff to your brother and sister as well?
I don't know.
Don't know.
I've never spoken about it. So, you know, and then they'd be doing things like, I remember one time, this one drug dealer, he used to like play fight with me all the time, and then one day he like hit me in the garden because I'd ran over to play fight with him. I think I was only like 7. And he went into the house, sold drugs or whatever he was doing in the house, came out, and he had his little right-hand scally mate in the car with him, and they grabbed me from the garden and put me in the boot of the car, and then started bombing around the estate, and you know, skidding around, going over speed bumps, and I'm obviously bouncing everywhere in the boot of this car, and I'm screaming because, you know, it's dark and wanting to someone to hear me, and then I can hear them turn the radio up and then turn it down, and they're laughing, and then they pull up outside, open the boot, drop me off, and I just remember standing there crying so much, but I couldn't make any noise. It's like I was sat, you know, when you cry and you can't make any noise, and almost, I don't know, wanting my mum to hear me cry. And then when I finally, like, everyone was sore, I was hurt, you know, and when I finally was able to stop crying and, like, make a noise, I was like, well, no one's going to care anyway. And then I just went back on with my day. And, yeah, that was like, one example of some of the things that were going on. And it just seemed to be those things were happening all the time.
And the violence that... Would they come in and beat you up? Would a drug dealer come in and beat you? Or
that not like that was mainly like either my stepdad or like I say, the odd time a random drug dealer or one of the kids on the estate would like beat you up or just trick me. I just felt like I was always getting tricked. People were gaining me trust because I was a kid. someone shows you a bit of niceness, you're gonna start to trust them. Coming, you know, one of this old lad once was like, you know, even went to the point of defending me against someone who's bullying me just to get me on my own. And then was like, come and sit on this wall with me, and this big 6 foot wall, and there's a garden behind it full of nettles. And then he was like, you're okay? He put his arm around me, and I was like feeling like, I don't know, not safe, but for the first time I've got a friend. And he just pushed me backwards, and I landed in this whole garden full of nettles. And I remember just being covered head to toe in nettles. And again, who have I got to go and tell? Nothing I can do.
I mean, you were vulnerable. The most vulnerable child.
Yeah.
And it sounds, were you craving attention? Was that why you trusted people? That's what I'm feeling when you're speaking.
I suppose, yeah, like, yeah, like, the people who are closest to you, your mum and dad, or your mum and stepdad, because there was no trust or no like comfort or safety around them. Anytime anyone showed me a bit of comfort or safety, I suppose I latched onto it a bit because I needed it. I just felt like I was sinking. I felt like I was in sinking sand. That morning, that first Christmas, was like I'd stepped into sinking sand that day, and I was slowly sinking from that point onwards. And I just needed to grab hold of someone, something. And every time I did, it was like coming to the sinking sand, and they were reaching out the hand. And then when I was going to grab the hand, they were going, ha, and pulling the hand away.
Maybe pushing you in
and
a little bit.
Yeah,
as well.
And that bit of movement of me reaching makes me sink more. And it just ruined me trust, I suppose, for humanity, for everyone.
I'm not going to push too much into it. You said there was sexual crime, I suppose, put against you, as well as a psychological neglect. Did this span over a short period of time, or was this a constant up until the age of 7?
It was separate to, like I say, it wasn't like a consistent thing, because people weren't consistent in my life. People would come and go. The first time, it's really difficult for me to talk about, but at the same time, because of what happened, I believe things to be worse because of you start to see things as normal, the way that's normal, that's the way of living. And the first time it happened was, and I've never spoken about this, was one of these people just was like, started obviously touching me and tell me to do things. And that was like one of the times where I first learned to detach myself from my own, a weird way of like detaching myself from my own, which I found very useful. I did, you know, look at a dot on the wall and just remove your mind from your body. I started doing that from that point onwards. And so that was like the first occasion of my experience of things like that. Later on, it was not even connected to me household. It was two older lads who did things which were more based on like, it's an extreme word to say, but like based on like the torture side of things, you know, like, which I suppose if you look at it is the sexual things involved, but more like putting things in me and laughing and torturing, doing things to hurt me, and but not like severely hurt me, just punishment. You know, there was this place where obviously you can't get away from it. You can't, because I'm living at it, you know, where can I go? I'm so young, and what can I do? And sometimes, I suppose it goes back to earlier on when you're saying about being in the house and being out the house. Sometimes I suppose I did want to get out the house to try and just breathe. But then I knew when I'd get out of the house, I was going out to what I was going out to. And sometimes I'd want to get away from the outside world and get back in the house to breathe from that. And I suppose one of the most worst things that happened with those kids was they held me. They used to, I can hold my breath for a long time. And people always go, oh, you've got, you know, I said, I can hold my breath for like 4.5 minutes. And the reason for that, I believe, was they used to hold me under the water, thinking it was funny, and just almost like drowning me. And the way of me dealing with that was, well, if I can hold my breath for as long as I can, they're not going to do it to me anymore, because they're not going to get me kicking and screaming and fighting. But they did, and I couldn't hold my breath for that long. So yeah, there was those occasions where it's just crazy. I can't even, sometimes I look back or think back and think to myself, did that really happen to me? Is this the world we live in? You know, that's crazy. Like, it feels like a different life. You know, from me sitting here today, it doesn't feel like that was me. That was my life.
Was there any joy?
No. I got asked this question recently. Or it was not a question. It was something I was watching online, and it was saying about thinking back to a good childhood memory. And I really struggled with thinking back to a good childhood memory, because my answer to that in my head was, I don't have one. There were occasions of, and I remember them specifically because I suppose it's the only time where I'd laugh or I'd have a bit of fun on the estate. Estates are mad places. If you've grown up on an estate, you know that, you know, one of the other kids' dads who's actually still poor, but they're a good dad, might one day be like, have like a quad bike out on the estate, and they might give you a backy. And when I got included in that on those days, stuff like that, you felt like on top of the world. And I remember probably my first ever memory, to be fair, of happiness was some random lad had a mountain bike. I was too small to get on it, and he put me on it, and although it ended badly and pushed me down the hill, I don't know why he did it. Maybe he thought I was going to crash anyway, but I don't care, because I remember flying down that hill. And I can still feel the wind on my face. And I remember just laughing my head off, like, this is, you know, this is amazing. And then I got to the end and I couldn't reach the floor and just crashed, scraped on my knee and that. But yeah, I always remember that memory. I don't know why. No matter what was going on in my life then, that was fun, I suppose. That doing that was fun. So,
tell me about your dog.
Yeah. Sorry, I don't even know. I love dogs so much, so it's, you know. Yeah, this one memory, again, like the flyaway, we had this dog, and sometimes I'm like, well, how do we have a dog? We didn't have anything to live with, we had a dog. I suppose this was in the middle of like the decline, so we had things, but things were getting worse and worse. We had this dog, which I loved. It was like, you know, I used to live with this dog under the stairs. I used to sleep with her. I'd come down in the night time and cuddle up to her because it was warmer, cuddling up to the dog and stuff. And I became very, I remember this because I remember thinking that, I always remember thinking, the dog's happy and it can't speak, it doesn't have anything, just has me. And so I stopped speaking. I remember I didn't speak for a long time. I don't know how long it was, but I almost became like mute. I remember that, physically, consciously making the effort not to speak. Why should I speak? Why should I say anything? Why should I make a noise? No one ever hears me anyway. So I stopped, and me and this dog became best friends. And one time, it pooed on the kitchen floor, which obviously had never been trained. It was just a mongrel. And this guy came in and started battering the dog. So this was the first time in my life I ever felt like there was a bit of fight in me. And I remember running and jumping on his leg and wrapping my arms and my leg, arms and legs round his leg. And I started growling and I bit his leg. Obviously, I was tiny and he just shook me, like kicked his leg, and I flew into the cupboard. He continued battering the dog. And then he grabbed me and the dog, threw us in the, like, a little tiny brick courtyard back garden. And I'll always remember that, specifically that point. Of I was crying my eyes out, mixture of me being hurt and mixture of me dog was, you know, my dog was, it was howling and it hurt me so much, I don't know why. And it was raining outside and me mum wasn't in, she was out getting money for whatever she was doing. And I remember just crawling over to the dog and it was lying there just yelping, and I cuddled up to it in the rain and we just stayed there. And it went from day to night. And I remember just lying there next to it, shivering, and it weren't moving. I don't know whether it was okay or not afterwards, but the back door got opened. Can't even remember who it was, whether it was me mum or, but anyway, I got taken in. This was, I don't know what time it was, but I'd been lying there, like I say, in the rain. It rained all day. And I remember thinking, at that point, I wish it just stopped raining, you know, just one thing, just please, just let me have one thing. Didn't. So, I went back in and don't remember the dog again. I think they told me that because we were moving, we couldn't have a dog in the next place, and then the dog was gone. They said they'd give it away to someone, I'm pretty sure. But whether they did or they didn't, I don't know what happened to it.
Do you remember going into foster care?
Yeah. Yeah, I remember social services getting involved. Can't remember how they got involved, but they did. Whether it was through school or, you know. Mm. And I remember the day that they came. I remember hating social services because it's the most weirdest concept in the world. They were taking us away from this bad place. Yet I hated these people for taking us away from. I suppose it was they were taking you away from something you knew. It's a life that is not great, but I know it. I remember, I suppose it's probably the first time I remember me mum showing any type of real care. And it was when they literally pulled my little brother or my little sister out of her arms in the street on the estate, and I could see this baby crying and my mum was crying. And it's like she'd realised what she'd done, but it was too late now. And they took, weirdly, they took the babies first and left us because they were going to come back the next day. So it's like we knew what was coming. Mm. And the next day we went into care, and it was amazing because obviously I hated what they were doing. I felt like these intruders were coming and taking us, you know, kidnapping us sort of thing. But I went to this place, this woman called Debbie. Amazing. You know, like I was like, I've walked into a film here. You know, and I remember sitting at a breakfast table and this lovely older woman, lovely little house, they had Jack Russell, and the guy was like a bricklayer, just a normal guy. They were like, I don't know what I expected in to go into care. And this is what's kind of like, it's so frustrating for me, is that I went there and it was brilliant. And I remember the first memory of that was her opening the fridge and being like, do you want some sausage? Do you want some sausage? And I was like, yeah. And then she was like, I've got some of this as well. I've got some of that. And then it was just before you knew it, I had this plate, like a full English breakfast. I think that was my first ever fry up I had. And I was like, this is amazing.
You're
and
seven?
I think it must have been about eight then, maybe.
All right, okay.
Yeah, getting older. Or nine, eight. Yeah, because social services got involved, you see, but they didn't take us. It wasn't like they got involved and it was like, bang, we're gone. They, like, it was a process of, like, we're involved now. You need to change what's going on. So, obviously, my mum failed to do that. So, yeah, and I think this is great, but from what I know, maybe getting it wrong because I don't know about how social services work, but you have, like, short-term foster carers and long-term foster carers. And there was, I was only there for a couple of months and then I moved to a more permanent place. And it was almost a big tease in itself, that place that I went to her house, because it was like, look at what you can have in life. And then I went somewhere else and it wasn't the same abuse as I was receiving when I was at home, but I was still then receiving, it still wasn't great, basically.
So the long term?
Yeah, when I started moving to the next place and the next place.
Were they all homes?
No.
Like people's houses?
People's houses, yeah. Yeah. There's no, when we went into foster care, I don't think there's such thing as a home anymore, where there's like all together a load of kids.
Yeah.
They are, the ones that exist now or then are like for kids who are like really bad, the kids who are naughty. And it's almost like a prison, if you like, for kids. But there's no, like, you know, you're old. In the olden days, they're like a home, an orphanage full of kids. It's just a house with a foster carer. And
these foster carers were what would be abusive towards you as well?
Not in the same, nowhere near in the same way as, like, what was going on at home. But you're in with other foster kids. You're in with older foster kids, younger foster kids, different families are involved and different families aren't involved. Some foster carers where you go in the house and you have a lovely downstairs and you have a lovely kitchen, and a foster social worker comes in and it's, this is Nathan, this is the new great meeting, and then the social worker goes and then they go to you upstairs and you go into a room where there's nothing other than a bed. Amazing, it's a bed. I never ever at any point was like, oh, look at this is terrible. But when I look back on it now, it's like, that was just a facade you were putting up for the social services, when really you were just after the money of getting as many kids in the house as you could. And then you could tell by when you went upstairs, there was no, again, I always referred it back to Debbie's, the first place. She obviously got paid to be a foster carer. She made the point, I remember this because she bought me my first ever set of, like, I remember my first ever set of clothes, and I remember telling me openly in the car, you know, I pay the bills that we need to pay, food and that. Anything that's left, she was like, anything that's left every month, what do you want? What do you need? What do you want? And every month she'd make a point of getting me exactly what I wanted. And I never asked for much because I didn't want much, but she did not do it for the money, you know, at all.
But you've gone from somewhere where you used to get bullied intensely, you know, with your peers, I suppose, because you had nothing, and you, yeah, like, in your words, you was the drug addict's kids.
Yeah.
To a place now where you feel better because you've got clothing on and you're getting looked after and fed,
yeah,
and you felt safe. Did you then feel betrayed?
I hated the social services even more, and I also regret, and I still do, because, I mean, it's not my fault. As lovely as she was, I didn't trust her, and she was probably the only person I could have trusted. I still was like, this is great, but I'm not falling for your tricks. And I was always ready, always lying there at night time thinking, not being able to sleep, thinking what's going to happen. And nothing ever did happen there, other than care, what it was designed for, foster care. But yeah, so we moved on. And then the bullying, this is where I'm starting to get into like older age now, like going into, started to head towards high school. So I'd been to a couple of different foster placements and stuff, and for some reason, the bullying just followed me around outside of the home life, wherever that home life may have been, and even bullying within certain foster placements from other foster kids. And again, not on ever severe as what had happened, but it was just still like, I could never feel safe. I could never feel okay. The bullying outside continued, and my first year in high school, I was selected for this thing they call the Beats, which is like you pick one person in a year and every time you see them, you beat them up.
Is that the older kids? Or the kids in the
same year?
Oh, same year.
Same year. They'd got it from the older kids. Mm. So some of them had brothers in like year nine, and like that was a thing in year nine as well. Probably some other poor kid in year nine getting it done to them. So I became very good at hiding then, and I realised that by running away and hiding, I can avoid getting beaten up by all these kids, and, you know, they sellotape me to a tree in the woods and just left me, pull me pants down. And like, that may sound funny to some people, but when I'm the life I've had, and then I'm getting that as well, and they just, you know, just stuff, bullying, constant bullying. So I couldn't fight it. You know, on the estate, I'd had actually a couple of fights, but in between that first instance of fighting out with the dog, you know, jumping on his leg, from there, I got a bit more of a fight in me then from somewhere. And on the estate, when some other kids would try to bully you my age, they'd beat me up, I'd fight back. Mm. Old lads, I'd try and fight back, never ever win. I remember specifically in year seven, for the first time since that incident, where the dog incident, where I gave up on fighting back, even in my mind, because it was the first time all my life I'd said to myself, if I can make it to becoming an adult, no one's going to hurt me. No one's going to, I'll be able to protect myself, feed myself, look after myself. Just make it, just make it, just make it. And I suppose it became that overwhelming in that year with all that bullying in school that I didn't fight back anymore. And in my mind, I went, I can't make this, can't do it. And I started to run away, like saying hide and stuff. And then I quickly found that actually, even really naughty in school, they'll put me in a room with a teacher on my own, and I was like, okay, I'm safe. So I was became dead naughty then. Sometimes even doing what the bullies are asking me to do to try and like befriend them, if you like, and
yeah, appease them. Yeah.
So I became very naughty in school and outside the school. You know, I got moved to a couple of other really good foster carers, but I was just too naughty. I was like, I need to be on the move, because on the move I'm safe, because on the move I can hide.
Mate, you were surviving.
Yeah.
At every point of your life so far until this point, you were surviving.
Yeah. That's when the running away started. So I started running away from foster care then.
To where?
Where I'd sleep in woodlands, walk as long as I could, out in one direction, on the Wirral. And I always got caught. You know, I always get caught by the police. It'd only be a day or so, whatever, or 2 days. And obviously social services do have a responsibility as a kid missing. So then they're like, oh, we've got to find, the police get called. And then I remember getting on a train and thinking, okay, they catch me here, let's see how far I can go. And I ended up in Wales, I was about 12, possibly going 13, going 13. And I remember thinking to myself, they ain't getting me here. And it was actually, I didn't know then, but it's Betty Goad. Don't know if you've been there.
Yeah, I've been, lovely.
Amazing place. And I remember getting off the train station there and looking up and being surrounded by mountains and thinking, nobody's finding me here. So I'd go off up into the hills behind Betty Coad, and I found this abandoned farm. And the farm was rubble. Still half built, but like rubbly. And I used to step there as long as I could. And then when I was literally starving, go down to the train station, get caught by the ticket inspector. He'd be like, what are you doing here? Call the police. They'd come and get me, take me back to a new foster carer. But then it was in me then. It was like, okay, tin food is what I need. And I just start building, stealing money. Because I thought, I only need, the important part is getting there. So I asked one day at the train station, how much is a ticket to here? The guy was like, 13 quid. So I was like, okay, 13 quid. Sometimes I didn't have it, I just bunked. Sometimes I'd steal pounds for here.
So you'd go back there all the time? Back to the farmhouse?
Yeah.
You take food with you and just...
Tins, and stay as long as I could until I couldn't stay any longer. Pathetic attempts to catch animals and never caught anything. Thinking I was like, you know, I just couldn't do it. I was trying to catch rabbits and fishing. Didn't even know what I was doing, I think. made like a wooden hook. Just stupid. Entertaining myself, got nothing to do all day. But I remember for the first time there feeling safe in my life. And then I went up there and I remember for the first time thinking, I don't want to go back anymore. And this was the first time that I wasn't just thinking about, why am I here? I don't want to be here anymore. It was the first time I thought to myself, I'm not going to be here anymore. I actually can make this stop now. And I'd planned to go up to the farmhouse, the rubble. And I remember there being like a big storm that night. And I was like, that's why I moved down. It's funny how you learn how to like, I'd not been taught anything, but I learned that like when it was quite cold and bad, I'd move closer to the train station. Sometimes I'd even go to the train station and sleep in the train station and then go back up. And this was one of those nights because the train station was open all night in terms of like there was no one there, but there was cover. There was even public toilets and everything down there. Really nice village. So I'd go down there when it was bad. And I remember thinking, I'm going to go up there tomorrow. And I'm not coming back down. And no one's ever going to see me again. And when I went up there, it was rubble even more. And there was no, like, couldn't get in the farmhouse really. And there was not like this big beam that's still there now, broken. Wasn't broken the day before, it was the next day. I remember thinking, kind of like kids do, oh, that's that. You know what? There's a big, massive river. To me, now I'm an adult, it's not that big. But those rapids there looked huge. Thought, I'm going to go and just jump in there. It's just going to stop. You know, as soon as I do that, I'll be fine. It'll be okay. And I walk down to the river and I'm standing there, and then I remember this guy leaned his head over the top of the river with his beard and looked like a homeless guy. He was like, "You all right?" And I looked up, didn't get a chance to respond, and he was gone. And then I'm looking back at the river and obviously I'm starving as well. I'm starving and I'm thinking, I'm gonna jump in here. Am I? Yeah, no. I'm like, I'm debating with myself. Because obviously I'm saying to myself, walking down this mountain, I'm going to do this. And then when I get there, I'm like, not able to, you know, I'm like, there's a fight going on in my mind, which I would learn later on in life. I was going to have that fight a lot. He appeared behind me and he didn't say anything to me. And then takes his bag off and he opens his bag and unpacks this tinfoil pack and takes a scotch egg. He had two, like the large scotch egg as well, not the little ones. Takes a big bite out of one and then just pulled his hand out and says, "You want one?" And without even thinking, like, I was over, I got it and started eating it. Like, you know, wasn't even looking at him. I had my head down just eating this scotch egg because I think it had been like two days before I'd had anything to eat. Ran out of tins for a couple of days anyway. And then by the time I looked up, he'd gone. He just walked off. And then I remember feeling satisfied. Didn't feel like anything towards him or like this good person or anything like that. I just felt my hunger was satisfied. Like I just had something in me. And the thought of jumping in had gone. There was no like debating going on now. And I went straight to the train station, got caught, went back home. And things changed then for me. I went there again, I think a couple of times with me. Funnily enough, I'd come across my younger brother in a foster place.
All right.
So I was in a different one, he was in a different one round the corner. And we ended up being in the same foster house, the foster placements, and they were good people. I was a nightmare at this point. And this was when I was like getting into like teenager years. So I took him up there because we were starting to get into our like camping. And we went up there and built a shelter. And it became a place where like, you know, I've been there since. It's not a place of like where I don't want to go anymore. But yeah, I went up there a couple of times, but it was never ever to run away again. You know, it was never running away there. It was because I wanted to go there and do some camping and whatever. And
but it's a safe place as well, isn't it? You know, the area.
I suppose,
you
know, yeah. Maybe I wanted to show him that this was a safe place. I don't know what underlying thing made me say to him, "Let's go here." Because he was only, I must have been only 14, 15.
You don't analyse stuff when you're that age. You just do.
Yeah, yeah.
And all the way so far, you've just been doing.
Yeah.
On instinct.
Yeah, and
reaching out for the Scotch egg.
Yeah,
you know, coming down when there's a storm, hiding, surviving, appeasing, all this thing you're doing on instinct. You got into MMA when you was 14.
Yeah, probably just going 15. So like, I remember being around the end of 14.
Mm.
But that was right after around the time where I took my brother up to this hill. We never went back because we nearly died. I'd been watching Bear Grylls, so found this hole in the ground, sticks across it. Like we're gonna camp and we'll have a fire. Layered loads of moss over it, wet moss. Layered more over it. It was you couldn't lift this shelter up. It was heavy, and then it was like you went down a little hole and into it. It was an amazing shelter. We built it. It took us all day. Had a fire inside it. Dark, cold. Sleep. Said to him, don't light that fire again. He lit the fire. And the moss all over the top of the roof of the shelter had dried out. It just went up. I remember hearing him shouting me. He was outside. He'd already got out. And the only one way out, I tried to squat up and lift it. And I couldn't lift it. And there was flames going across the entrance, and I just had to like put my hand over my face and crawl out as fast as I could. I remember we're on this side of this mountain, both of us. I'm 14, he's like 13 or 12 or something. He's young. And we're both weeing on it to put it out. And then I'm like, well, we can't go down this mountain in the dark. So we get back in it, half burned down shelter. We both just fall asleep. It takes fire again.
Yeah.
Because of an ember or something. And I was like, so we got out. That's because we'd ripped half it down, so we got out easily. And then we were like walking down this mountain. I was holding onto his like shoulder, he's holding to me. And then we got to the train station, slept in the train station, and then got the train home. Never went back there after that, like until I was an adult. But
why did you get into MMA? Was it to defend yourself?
Yeah, so I was getting bullied in school, and with adults it was kind of like this rootless, like, I don't know, unsaid thing that there's nothing you can do about that. It's an adult. You can't fight against an adult. You know, with the kids in school, I started hearing about this cage fighting thing going on. And I was like, okay. And it was when my brother who went down and actually was going to go down to watch him get beat up. And then he did one session and left and didn't do it again. I did the same session and never left. Fully with the intention of going into school one day. Or waiting outside school. I'd been expelled, so... I had loads of free time then, and going in and beating them up, I was like, you know, this, I can do something about this. They're my size, and now I've got a skill. I'm training with these men. I got really good really quick. But I joined the gym when I was 14 and a half, going on 15, 28 now. Never had a fight outside the gym. And the reasons for me joining was to precisely do that, is to go and fight these people and hurt them. But... I went
to have the skill. So it's things like wrestling, Brazilian jiu-jitsu, boxing.
Thai boxing, yeah. 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 Just a whole mix of stuff.
A whole mix.
And I'm going into a sport that's relatively young in the UK. There's no kids doing it. I was a kid, so I'm training with all these men. And it was the first time I ever felt a part of something. I had these men, these grown men, big gnarly men, and they were caring for me like a child, but included me and respected me like I was a man. It's a weird thing that, you know, I was involved in everything because I was very mature, but then they'd buy me some lunch from the shop, you know, or they'd take me out for something to eat, and I became a part of this little family, and it was good, and I excelled, you know, I excelled at it. I learned quickly. I started competing and doing quite well. Again, there wasn't many kids in the country, so, you know, a lot of time you're competing against men. And as I started to get older and compete more, it got more harder. I don't know why, but I just started to feel like that the fear of failure, especially considering I'd done quite like really good. I'd been unbeaten in most things. I was like, no one could beat me in at my weight and my categories and all these different things. And then there were occasions where like I'd have my first ever boxing match, even though done loads of fights, and I lost the boxing match, and I went and cried my eyes out for like 4 hours. Like, it wasn't that big of a deal. But to me, it was all my life I had nothing, and then I've got this thing, and people are saying to me, you're going to be in the UFC. that you have got, your life is going this way. And I became not afraid to fail at it. That, you know, that saying, don't let the fear of striking out, don't let the fear of failure prevent you from don't let the fear of missing the ball prevent you from striking out, mm. or something like that. That's what happened to me. I started feeling pressure. Throwing up, first thing I remember, was before my fight. I was about to fight that day. Then that had extended the day before. Then it was like I'd get told I was having a fight, and then 2 weeks out I'd be feeling horrendous. And then it got to the point where someone would come in the gym, say, got you a matchup, and my whole world would be like spin.
So just crippling anxiety.
Yeah. And then I would pull out of fights. I'd fake injuries. I've hurt myself. You know, really, really stuff that I felt really ashamed of as well. And then it got to the point where I was like, if I don't compete, I don't ever lose. So I can't fail if I don't try. And that was that's what derailed that for me. It was all hidden inside. No one really knew. They just saw this lad who was great, 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 great at the sport. And why is he wanting to go and join the Marines? At then I was like, I'm going to join the Marines. I met a guy in the gym he'd left the Marines. That's what I'm going to go and do. Run away, get away from it. You know, 15 years and 9 months. 15 years and 9 months is the earliest day you can go into the careers office.
So you did do that. You joined.
Yeah.
You got to week 27.
Yep.
And then what?
So...
Because that's only a few weeks before the end.
Yeah, it is. I think it's important to say that before that, in that period where I was like wanting to get away, I actually met my best friend now. It's really, really important because for the first time in my life, him and his wife, I met him because he wanted to learn MMA. So, and I'm so glad because I used to beat him up and now he absolutely destroys me, but I'll always be able to say, when you didn't know nothing, I used to get you.
Yeah.
And one day I will again. But it was almost like for the first time, I had all these nice people in the gym who were like caring for me. For the first time, he seen my life and went, that's not okay. And he like physically stood up for me. He was like, no. What's, you know, you feeling like this? What's going on? No. And I was like, well, what can I do? And he was like, come and live with me.
Is he older?
Yeah. He had just left the army, the Vet Corps. And he literally was like, I was like, what can I do? Where can I go? I've got nothing. And he was like, I'm like 15 at this point, I think, or 16. Can't remember exactly. But anyway, he was like, you can come and live with me. I was like, what do you mean? I've only known you a few. He's like, yeah, come and live with me. And I went into his house and I stayed on his couch and then in the spare room with his wife and his little boy who had met, who was only three. And they became my family. They for the first time in my life, I was like, this is like, they love me, they care for me, you know, I'm a part of this family. And I stayed there as long as I needed to. And this was while I was waiting to go into the Marines. And he just supported me in every single, you know, yeah, you want to join the Marines? Great, you do it. You know, support me. Don't want to join the Marines? When I left, he was there for me. But yeah, so I joined the Marines, thinking that was the right thing. I want to get away. Got to week 27. And again, the mind, the mental thing, the fear of, it was a weird one. It was like, it wasn't so much the fear of failure because I was doing really well. There was no issues with me soldiering, with me fitness, with anything. It was almost like, what if I do pass? What if I do succeed? And that sent me into a mad tailspin, and I was like, I need to get out of here. And that pressure came on again then, and almost the pressure of like, no, you would never succeed at this. Something's going to happen in the next few weeks and you're going to fail. And then in my head I was like, I need to go right now. And I literally ran out of camp that night. Like, people were looking for me on camp. I heard all these mad stories about, oh, he's climbed a fence of rope, he's cut his way out of this. And I was like, in the end, I just ran up the road, waited till the car was going out to the barriers, ducked under and just bailed. Got on the train, went home to Harry, basically to the Wirral. And he was like, listen, if you don't want to be there and you don't want to do it, then don't do it. You know, he was always very understanding on me, always very like supportive of anything I wanted to do, which was the first time in my life was like, was weird because I never thought that was okay. don't want to go. Okay, you want to go? Okay. Change your mind every other week. But I'll take you to the train station and back every other week. He didn't, you know, it was just supportive of me. Went back there a week later because obviously he can't just run away. I had the conversation with the CEO and he was like, you know, I don't think I know anyone who's ever left voluntary at this point. You're making a mistake. And in 2 weeks' time, when you realise that mistake, you have to go into the careers office and come back because we want you to be a Royal Marine. But you'll have to do training again. You do know that. I don't know whether he was just saying that to make me go, oh, I'm not going. But I said, no, I'm going. Don't want to do this anymore. In my mind, I was saying to myself, I'm going to go back and I'm going to get in the UFC. You know, that was like, because that was like my career that I should have done and that I ran away from in my mind. And I'm going to go back and I'm going to do really well. But I think that was just my mind justifying myself. Oh, you've got something to leave
there's
for.
There's also these things like, if you look at self-harm, people just think it's physical, but there's also that kind of self-sabotage as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Look at your past. And quite often your past does dictate where you go, good and bad, whether it's traumatic, chaotic, whatever it is, but you can't outrun everything.
No.
And I'm sure there was some self-sabotage in that, for whatever reason.
Yeah. And I remember 4 weeks after that, sitting in the car with Harry and crying my eyes out, saying, what have I done? I've made the mistake. I shouldn't have left. But again, he helped me, picked me up, got me a job with him and taught me, gave me my dog, Storm, and trained me up as a dog handler there. She passed away last year. So that was so hard because that was the first time in my life that this is like getting emotional, but this is like happy emotional. Without jumping ahead too much, that was the first time in my life last year, where I lost something that I loved. So I'm 27 years of age. I've never lost anything that I've loved because I've never loved anything. And the things that I do love, or, you know, like Harry, like my partner, everyone who I'd love, I've not lost them. They're there. You know, I've never had a granddad or a nan who's that, you know, nothing like that. So when my dog died, it was like, wow, this is what it's like to lose something that you love. But yeah, I remember getting there as a puppy with Harry. Had brought it to me and I got a job then with him, and I just fell into this circle, and it's this circle of getting jobs, leaving to pursue this dream career in mixed martial arts, panicking, going back to a job, getting into debt, started getting into a lot of debt. I just felt like a failure.
Lots of young men do that. Lots of young men don't lose things, you know, until later on. You know, I don't think I was, my granddad died probably in my early 20s. That's probably the first time. But I had a good unit around me, you know, like, and then I joined the army at 16 and all the rest of it. So you have different challenges here to get to this point, you know, and also it's not a case of just losing something you loved. Actually, something loved you as well.
Yeah.
And it was two ways there where, I don't want to put words in your mouth, it just appears that was very limited in your life, this two-way transaction.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
I'm going to move us forward. You know, like you said, there was this cycle of, you know, job after job, you know, didn't know what you was. There was a stint on MasterChef that you went on as well. You were still involved with martial arts. You got your brown belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in 2020.
I think so, yeah.
About that time.
Yeah.
But I want you to tell the story. Des Fraser came and joined your gym.
Yeah. Des.
Yeah, and then said a story.
Yeah, so basically I'd been getting down days over the past few years, but they were like one day where I'd feel really bad, wouldn't want to leave the house. They got worse and worse and worse over the years, really bad. And yeah, we were in the gym, and for some reason, after a good hard training session, people like to talk and stuff, and we end up having this mad little therapy group. Like, we were all just talking on the couches, and Des mentioned a part of his story was an incident that he'd had where he ended up on a bridge, not wanting to be here anymore. Now, what he didn't know and what I was doing in that conversation, which I do a lot, is I just sit and listen, and I put my own input in very carefully without giving away anything about my own life. But I took note of exactly what he said, and because what he didn't know was a week before that conversation in the gym, I was standing on a bridge, and in that group of people in the gym there, Des was telling his story, and the only person who knew about this, me on the bridge, was Harry, because I told him the week before. But yeah, I just, what led to that was, it was weird. For the first time in my life, I wasn't in debt anymore. I wasn't surviving from anyone. I had a job that I enjoyed doing. I was okay for food. I had a dog. I had my partner. Had good home, house, everything that I could ever. I thought I've made it here, and it's not much. I'm not well off, but I thought I've made it here, and it was like those little down days that were common, and this grey cloud that has always followed me around everywhere I've gone. I've always never felt good. Always felt so there's something wrong. The moment I felt like everything was okay, that came worse. That grey card started turning black, and it became 2 days, and then it was a week where I'd feel like, I don't want to be here anymore. I don't want to be here. Everyone who is around me, I'm making their life worse. They're just trying to help me, and I'm just this, look at me, look at who I am. They would be better off without me. And I was telling myself these things, but fighting with myself every day, hard fighting. I'm not giving up. I'm fighting and fighting. I was sitting on my couch on a Thursday and watching TV. The next thing, I don't remember how I got there, I was standing on a railway bridge, and I came to consciousness, if you like, just hearing myself breathing deeply, shaking, not knowing how I got there. I don't know how long I've been standing there for. It was dark, no one around. And for some reason, I don't know why, but I was looking for my phone. First thing nowadays, and everyone's always on the phone. I looked for my phone, I patted my pockets, there was nothing, no phone, no keys, no nothing. But I felt something in my pocket, and it was a coin. So, you know, I reached into my pocket and got this coin out, you know, this 10p coin. And I put it in my hand and I said to myself, out loud, I don't know why I said it, if I'm meant to be here, let's see. And I said, heads, I'm going to jump, tails, I'm not. And I flipped it, and it landed on tails. As soon as it landed on tails, I started crying my eyes out, and I got down, and I had this like mad adrenaline rush. Like, there's been times where I've been climbing or I've been kayaking or something, I've done something of like, wow, I just nearly died. You know, you get like a little bit of adrenaline rush. It was like at times 100, like I was like, I just nearly died, and I didn't know what to do. For the first time in my life, that battle of should I be here, should I not be here, was non-existent. You know, I was on my couch, and then I was on a bridge. There was no battle. I remember thinking to myself that if I hadn't have came round to like consciousness standing there, my last memory would have been just me sitting on the couch in pain with people who were around me who loved me and didn't know. So obviously I walk home crying my eyes out, didn't see a single person, sort myself out before I get back in my house, you know, because you can't show any weakness or sadness or tears in front of the people you love. I went in and just felt so embarrassed and ashamed, and then didn't tell anyone. I didn't tell anyone for a couple of days, and then, but I knew at that point when I was walking home that I really need help, you know, I need professional help. And I had spoke to people in the past, a couple of counsellors, but I never wanted the help. I got the help because of the people who were close to me were saying, you need to speak to someone. And I was going, okay, yeah, I'll go and speak to someone then. But I was doing it for them. I'd never opened up to the counsellor that I went to see. I just was like doing it for the sake of doing it. This time I was like, I need help. So that then led me to be in the gym next week. That conversation happened, and then I rang Des and was like, can I come round and speak to you? And then I went round to Des. At this point, I told two people, told Harry, told me partner. And I told him. I said to him, you know, the story you were saying the other day, well, this happened last week. And me and Des, we're talking for like an hour and a half, 2 hours in his. And he then said to me, there's a counsellor who I, you know, when I had that experience, I went to see a counsellor. This is the counsellor. Go and see him. So, and he advised a great bit of advice actually that really helped me. It might not help, it might not help other people, but for me, this was like, I did this and helped. He said, when you go in, because I think that's what he did, lay everything on him, everything that's ever happened to you, stuff that you've never told anyone. Don't get any counselling for it when you're there. Thanks. Don't want counselling. I don't want to hear what your thoughts or what we're going to work on. Here's all my stuff, and then leave. And that's what I did. I went in, told him everything that I'd never told anyone, all of the details, everything. And I said, thanks. I don't know whether I'll be back. And I left. And I explained it like all my life, I felt like I was carrying this rucksack. And every day someone would come along and put a brick in it. And it got heavier and heavier and heavier to the point where I couldn't lift it anymore. And for the first time in my life, it felt really like someone had come along. And I walked out that counselling session, opened the bag and took one brick out, and I was just a little bit lighter. And that's what made me go back the next week. And then I started having counselling. And it was Des, obviously, and yourself. I tried to, it's important to say because I appreciate it a lot. I tried to pay and he was like, no, it's already all sorted for. It's already all sorted. And it was you guys who'd sorted that for me, and he wouldn't let me pay. And I suppose one of the first times in my life that was strange for me, because I had people who cared for me who were new, loved and trusted. So I'd expect that from someone who loved to go, oh no, I'm going to sort this out for you. Or I'm going to, you know, like I would try and sort stuff out for people. But I didn't really know Des that much. I'd not met you. And to think that these strangers were like insisting on helping me, like it wasn't an option, he was like, no, it's sorted, was like such a strange, it made me start to see actually there is I knew there's good people in the world because there were people who were close to me, but I thought like they were part of my circle, and outside that circle the world's bad, everyone in it's bad, and I don't like the world. It made me realise that no, the world, there's goodness in the world, even from people who don't even know me, and they're willing to want to help me. So I'm grateful for that help.
Sometimes you need a little arm around the shoulder, and it comes in different ways. It might come from a Scotch egg on the bank of a Welsh river, or it might come from an impromptu conversation in a kitchen. Yeah. You know, that leads to whatever. I suppose it leads to sat down today.
Yeah.
What's next? I can see you're in pain, mate. I can still see you in pain.
Yeah.
And this is going to take time, and but you're on a different path now. You said a second ago, you're not allowed to cry, you're not allowed to be emotional in front of the people who you love or show weakness.
Yeah.
Des speaks. That opens then something for you to then speak to him.
Yeah.
You're speaking now, which will affect someone else. He listened to somebody else speak.
Yeah.
It's a cycle but the people are still in battles. They're still having to work at things. And like I said, there's still pain involved with that. And
yeah, definitely.
But you can't, it takes pain to get better.
It does, yeah. I've said this before recently, and it's the hardest thing in the world for me to do was to speak. The hardest thing I've ever faced was to speak that first time. It's also the easiest thing in the world to do because we speak every day. Once you speak openly, honestly, truthfully about what it is that you're not talking about, life changes. It becomes easier. You know, not being able to cry and not being able to, it's exactly that what you need to do. I cry all the time now, and I'm not embarrassed by it anymore. I'm not afraid of it anymore. I feel better for it every time I do it. And it's just about showing that control of and understanding that you need to do these things because you've never done them. Even if you've never cried in your life because of all this trauma that you're suffering, you need to.
Can I ask you just some, I want you to answer them fairly quickly.
Yep.
And don't think too much. Were you ashamed of your mum and you as when you were little? Were you ashamed?
Yeah.
And are you proud of where you are now?
I am yet now. Now that
do you ever think about the trauma and the pain that your mum would have gone through in maybe her childhood? Do you ever think to be addicted to suppress the pain?
I have done, yeah. Yeah. One of the things I've recently grown from is that for me to move on and heal, that I need to forgive those people, all of them, because they're probably not thinking about me. All the people who hurt me, people who, you know, they're not thinking about me, but I'm thinking about them in the past. I'm letting them affect me in the present. So I forgave them all. I don't have to go see them. I don't have to be friends with them. But I forgave them all, genuinely took a step back from my own self and said, there's reasons why we all do things. And like you've just said, I don't know what the reason was for her being the way she was, but I'm sure there is one. And I forgave them. I forgave her. I forgave them all. Doesn't mean they need to be in my life. But once I did that, I was able to move on for myself. I didn't forgive them for them. I forgave them for me.
Mm.
And now I don't hold anything against anyone. I feel freedom from that.
Next week you start a journey. So a literal journey. What are you doing?
I'm walking 1,350 miles from John O'Groats to Land's End with no shoes on, barefooted.
So you replace this rucksack full of bricks, mate, with an actual rucksack full of camping gear. So that's what it is, self-sufficient.
Yeah, unsupported.
North to south.
Yeah. I'm doing that to raise awareness for mental health. I'm doing that to, in the process, I'll set a new world record, new Guinness World Record. That's just the cherry on top. It's a byproduct. I'm not doing it for that reason. That just comes with it, which is nice. Ultimately, I'm doing it for myself. As you said, I've still got a long way to go to heal. There's a load of reasons of why I'm doing this walk, how it came about, but the fact is I'm doing it. I wanted to symbolise in a physical way what it's felt like every day in my mind. And even a 1,350-mile barefoot walk for 60 days doesn't come close to the pain that I've suffered in my mind as to what I'm going to suffer in my body. And that's the kind of the statement I want to make to people, is that suffering in the mind, I believe to be far worse and is the most painful thing. You know, it's the biggest cause of pain.
And suffering in silence as well.
Yeah, in silence, definitely. I want to make people or help people to try to, even if one person just speaks out, because it will, it's something we all say, isn't it, all the time? Just speak out about it, just speak up about it. And it's kind of, I think it's kind of misunderstood and people go, oh, whatever. Can't be that simple. It can't be that easy. It can't be, I've been facing me right there in front of me that whole time. Just speak. No, my problems are so severe, so bad, so traumatic that I can't just simply speak about them and it's going to be okay. It is. It is that simple. You know, if one person hears what I'm saying and does something about it, then that'll make it all worth it. Mm. All standing on all those stones and hurting my feet, and there's going to be some grim days on it, I know that. But there's never going to be anything worse than I've been through. Mm. So,
and we'll attach all the and promote it as it goes. Was it Mind?
Yeah, I'm raising funds for Mind UK. They're a national charity, and the challenge is national. So that's why I wanted to do it for a charity where, like, it wasn't local to me, so all the funds that are raised are going to be, you know, directed towards something locally. I wanted to be able to help people all over the country, so they were the reason why I chose them. And yeah, it's going to be a journey. It's going to be an experience. And I've said this plenty of times, and I keep referring to it this way because this is the way I'm seeing life now. People have said, oh, when you get to the end, what are you going to do when you get to the end? And I keep saying, it's not the start to the end, it's the start to the beginning. And I've written that on emails before, and people have been like, you've spelt that wrong, you know. I'm like, no, it's the start to the beginning. And when I get to the to that point, I'm going to walk onto the beach, I'm going to walk into the water, and I can't walk anymore, I'm hoping that I'll have finally found something that I believe to be lost forever. And that's myself. I hope that I'll find myself.
Hi, it's Michael. Thank you so much for listening. It is Mental Health Awareness Week, and I'm asking for a little favour. If you've listened to this and you feel it could impact someone's life in a positive way, please send them a message with the link. If you can't do that, then please leave a review or post on social media. It really will mean a lot to an individual who gets to hear this.